Ed Senny, and I'm from Valparaiso University. That's where I have worked for the last 22 years, I believe it is, teaching in the Department of Theology. And my primary teaching responsibilities there have been in the area that we call history of religions, which most people in the general public call world religions or the great religions of the world or something like that. So a very large proportion of my time in teaching in these years has been spent exploring and teaching about non-Christian religions. The main course that I have taught in these years has been a kind of survey course of some of these religions, where you'll spend only a couple weeks on each of the major religions after having looked at primitive religions and some examples of that previously. So that's kind of who I am. I happened to get in on the staff here just as a sort of a last minute thing, because I was on sabbatical leave. I finally won a sabbatical and went to Tempe, Arizona. And there in that wonderful winter country, I spent from mid-January until just June the 9th, which is a good time to get out of there. And I was studying Native American religions. And this has been my first opportunity to really study the religious life of the American Indians. So that's what I've been doing most recently. So when I wrote to Pastor Witt and told him that we were going to be traveling through the Northwest during this time of year, is there any possibility that he had a cancellation on the faculty at Holden? And he wrote back and says, come on in. So I've been thrilled ever since. But now that I'm here, of course, I have this adjustment to make, because when I walk into a classroom of sophomores in college, I am almost sure that none of them know anything about any of these religions. And so I know where to start. You start from ground zero and build from there. And I'm not so comfortable about that here, because not that I'm afraid that I don't know enough to share an hour's worth of material with you on it, but that I don't know for sure how elementary to be. I'm going to start by opting to be pretty elementary. In talking about the religions that I will be discussing this week, I'm going to do something very daring, and that is to discuss Islam in one little hour session, or less than that, this morning. Now, whenever you start to do something like that, that's either arrogant, or it's stupid, or it's a good try and well-intentioned try, because what you want to do is begin to get people into the heart of another faith, into the core of it, so that they might begin to be able to appreciate a little bit what it really is about if they hadn't known before. It involves whetting the appetite, in other words, and that's what I will be wanting to do this week by these little one-shot things, rather than having a week study on Islam and planning that everybody should come back every day. We'll be doing these little one-shot things. Today I want to talk about Islam, tomorrow about Baha'i. Baha'i, a religion which was born out of Persia in the 19th century, a certain kind of Islamic setting there that it grew out of. And then let's see, on Wednesday I think I chose to talk about Buddhism, about how to wake up. And then on Thursday I want to share something about some Indians in Arizona whom the Jesuits taught a lot, but what they have now is not quite what the Jesuits intended. It is a very beautiful and dramatic combination of Yaqui Indian traditional life with Catholic Christianity. And their Easter ceremony I want to talk about a little bit on that day. And then finally on Friday, I would like to talk about shaping the encounter between Christian and non-Christian. What is the shape of that encounter? How shall we stand over against non-Christian faiths? So that's the ambitious little job, and some of you may wish to stay with me for at least some of that. I would like to begin this presentation about Islam In the way that every lecture should be begun in Islam, with a little invocation, in the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. And I'm sorry that I couldn't say that in Arabic, because I haven't studied Arabic. This little invocation, in the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, this is spoken time and time again in the ordinary daily activities of the Muslim. Before meals, before making a speech, before killing animals for food, before writing a letter or a book or anything of that sort. What it means to make this invocation throughout all these ordinary practices of life is that God is at the center. And if Islam is about anything, it is about not forgetting that God is at the center of life. The longer version, called the Al-Fatiha, the opening, is recited at every prayer ritual, the longer version of that little invocation. It's spoken on more formal occasions, and I'd like for you to hear how that goes, because sometimes when we hear the praying of other people, we get closer to the heart of their faith than we do when we just talk abstractly about their doctrines. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to God, the Lord of all being, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, the Master of the Day of Doom. Thee only we serve, to Thee alone we pray for succor. Guide us in the straight path, the path of those whom Thou hast blessed, not of those against whom Thou art wrathful, nor of those who are astray. So the invocation, spoken regularly. Well, we all know something, I suppose, about where Islam is nowadays. If we are awake to our news at all, we know that this whole Near Eastern region and Middle Eastern region is Islamic country. But Islam is not only in Egypt and Jordan and Lebanon and Iraq and Iran and so forth, but much beyond that as well. Very strong in northern parts of Africa. Indonesia, strongly Islamic, and many other parts of the world. But what maybe we do need also to realize is that it's pretty close to home. That is, at our little university of 4,000 students, we have several hundred, maybe that's exaggerated just a little, but over 100 usually, from Islamic countries on our campus. And we know them personally, and many of them are very careful about the practice of their faith while in the family of this Christian university. We begin to know them. And many of you live and work in environments where people from Middle Eastern countries who have been nurtured on the faith of Islam, where they live and work beside you. So we're talking then not only about understanding a far-off part of the world and maybe getting some help to understand what goes on over there, but we're also talking about the people we are likely to meet here in this country. Some vocabulary for a beginning. I've been saying the name of this religion, Islam. That is the name of the religion, not Mohammedanism. Please, never Mohammedanism. That was the old way in which Western Christian scholars referred to that faith. But Islam is very sensitive about that, and we should respect that, because it implies to those who hear that Mohammedanism, that perhaps Muhammad is to Islam what Jesus is to Christianity. And that they would like to keep clean. It is not the same, for Muhammad is not to Islam what Christ is to Christianity. So, not Mohammedanism, Islam, revealed to the Prophet as the name. So the one who practices, then, Islam is Muslim. The word Islam is a very elastic kind of word that it means submitting. It means being at peace with and in communion with and in harmony with. So it is oftentimes, to make it a simple story, it implies being in harmony with God by submitting to him as creature to creator. So Muslim is one who practices that faith of Islam. We always, of course, when we hear of Islam, we hear the name Allah. Allah is in fact not a name. And it is simply, it means the God. The God. And so it's not a name like Yahweh is in the Old Testament faith. It's not a name like any other God name. It simply is the God. Allah. And Allah, the God, was known and referred to in that way long before the time of the Prophet Muhammad. The Prophet, of course, spell it that way. I think that's the most acceptable way to spell it nowadays in English. Muhammad. We'll talk a lot about him in a minute. Continue vocabulary this way. Quran. Formerly, that was always done this way in English, but this is preferred nowadays, and you'll see this most often in modern writings. The house of prayer in Islam is called mosque. And then you have those spires around the mosques that are called minarets, those tall towers with the little balconies around them. I'm not going to write all of these on. And the muezzin, the one who climbs, who calls the community to prayer. So just that much about some vocabulary. Now, historically a little bit, with Islam, the setting, the historical setting in which it arises. This takes a little thinking, I believe, for a while to realize how very, very late in human history Islam came into existence. In the 7th century A.D. In the 7th century A.D., the Prophet was born in 570, died in 632. The entire revelation came to him in his lifetime. Now, what is the situation of Judaism in that time? Well, of course, Judaism has, by the 7th century A.D., has undergone all of the history of that Exodus and the land, coming into the land of Canaan, the exile, the return from exile, the attempts to reestablish, the second destruction of the temple in 70 AD, and the dispersion of Judaism throughout that whole part of the world, so that in the centers of the population centers of the Mediterranean north and North African coast and all throughout that region were pockets of dispersed Jews. Judaism then is that well established through that whole region, including Arabia, parts of Arabia there. Christianity, the young daughter of Judaism. By the 7th century, the canon of the New Testament is already in pretty good shape. The great councils of the church have been held, and the big discussions about orthodoxy and heterodoxy and the exclusion of some from the churches, the distinctions between now Orthodox Christianity and Monophysites and Arianism and all that stuff is taken care of and done. And we have this conversion of the great empire as Christian empire and at this time Byzantine empire. That's what's going on in that part of the world by this time. And there were pockets of Christians from where Islam began in Arabia, Mecca. There were pockets of Christians throughout that region, and well known along the great trade routes that passed through Mecca. So Judaism and Christianity, both claiming to be monotheistic religions, are well known in this whole region. Now let's ask, what is the situation with regard to Arabia itself there in the pre-Islamic times? These are times which the Quran refers back to as the times of ignorance, the times from before the Prophet Muhammad and the Revelation. The times of ignorance. What was the situation here in Arabia? Mostly it is a simple tribalism. That is, tribes of varying sizes, occupying certain territories in the desert here, and keeping the peace between each other as much as they could by their reputation for vengeance, by their warring reputations. They had a whole set of humanistic principles by which they lived their own communal life within their own tribes. You had all of that. You had the practice of religion, which involved the belief that there were many different kinds of spirits in the desert, beneficial ones and dangerous ones, and some gods related to some of the planets and the moon. We have that sort of thing in this region. Mecca, in particular, to zero in quickly to this center, Mecca was a great economic center in this time. It was in the barren deserts. There were no oases around there, but yet a great city grew up here in that barren desert based upon economics. Why? Because, if I had come straight from Valpo, I would have swiped a whole bunch of maps and slides and things, but I didn't. I came up from Arizona and traveled light. Maps. If you can picture that part of Arabia near the coast, we are at a crossroads of trade in the world of that time, so that from Mesopotamia, from the regions up there of Persia, and the whole Fertile Crescent, as it's all used to be called, we have trade from there going down into the Horn of Africa, down to the southern part of Arabia, and from there by boat over to India, and things from India, and most all of that, or an awful lot of that, had to pass near Mecca. And based upon these trade routes going through, Mecca became a great center of trade and a powerful economic center. The dominant tribe of people there, the Quraysh people, laid hold of that and really made the best of that economic situation. However, it seems, according at least to the Quran, to have been a very corrupt city by this time, by the time of the Prophet. For the good moral values of desert tribalism broke down and didn't seem to apply well in the city. And so individualism ran rampant. And the widows and the orphans were not cared for. The old and the sick were not cared for. And it was an individualism which reminds me a lot of ours, where power is based upon wealth, and reputation and everything is based upon how well you can individually turn that big dollar. And that seems to have taken over. And so it's described to us as a very wicked city. Enough about the setting. We need to get to the Prophet. In that kind of situation, the Prophet Muhammad is born in Mecca in 570 AD. There were influences upon him, to make a long story short about him, there were influences upon him which caused him to take the God very seriously. Even though there were many other gods in the area. And in the great shrine of Mecca, the Kaaba, which was dedicated to the God, there were at this time 360 images of other gods inside that little shrine. So the situation in which he is born is one in which many gods are honored, or believed in some sense, but where the God, supreme, original, creator God, is still remembered. And a few people in the city of Mecca seem still to have taken the notion of that one supreme God very seriously. And perhaps some of them were even monotheistic as a matter of principle in that setting. Well, some of those influences seem to have come to bear upon him, especially through his grandfather, who had a position as the keeper of one of the sacred wells there in the city of Mecca. Well, it was not until he was 40 years old, however, that the whole thing really began to roll. He was known by the people of the city as a man of prayer who went to the mountains nearby, to these desert mountains. I think I have a little better idea what desert mountains might be now that I've been in Arizona. And there he would pray all night. He would go beside the shrine of the Kaaba and he'd spend all night in prayer. He was known then as a man of prayer. And it was in the year 611 that the first revelation came to him. The first revelation from God. And he saw a figure standing on the horizon, reaching from heaven to earth, which he later is identified as Angel Gabriel. And that Angel Gabriel is the great messenger of God, bringing the message of Islam to him. And that figure said, "Recite. Recite thou in the name of thy Lord who created, for thy Lord is the most beneficent." And then I'm just taking a couple lines out of that first revelation. Watch your toes. One of the little clowns is down, going through here. My point in emphasizing recite is that is what the word Quran means. Quran is not a reading book, it's a recitation. It's to be chanted. It's to be listened to. It's a poetic presentation. It's a presentation rather than simply a passive thing, a batch of content here. Recitation. And so he received that recitation, and he remembered it, much to his surprise, perfectly when he came to himself. We can't dwell on what the psychological ramifications are of the experience of the prophets who receive messages. But he didn't know for sure whether this was for real or whether he was hallucinating like a sick man. And it took repeated experiences of revelation and reassurance from his closest friends and his wife at that time to help him process this experience that he was having until he began to accept the fact that he was to be the prophet of God in that day. And so he kept receiving these, and he began to preach the message in Mecca. And the message was, first of all, one God and one God only. To make any kind of companion to that God, to offer praise and worship to any other being as though that being participated in the being of God, is idolatry. It is infidelity. And God will hold human beings responsible for that infidelity. And so he preached a very radical form of monotheism. One God and one God only. And that monotheism was not only against those 360 idols that were in the Kaaba, but it was also a word against the Christians. For they had taken the prophet Jesus and had made him into God. And they had called him Son of God. And I won't go into those problems right now. But that, of course, is a very offensive thing to this monotheistic emphasis. The Trinitarian doctrine could not, it seemed, be reconciled with that. In Judaism, they accused certain Jews of having made the Torah, the law itself, into a kind of God to be worshipped, as they must have processed with it and paid reverence to it. And so things of this sort. Very strong emphasis upon monotheism. And that didn't go well in Mecca. You can say what you want to about me and my religion, but when you speak like this, you speak about my forefathers. And you speak as though they were all unfaithful to God, and that he will hold them responsible too. And so he was resisted and rejected. The second emphasis, I think, in his teaching or his preaching already in those first years was upon the relationship of the moral life to this God. The God continues to care about behavior, how we act. Now that may seem obvious to us, but in this society, as in so many societies, the matter of custom, appropriate action, morality, is a matter of the community. The living elders of the community reinforce it. And the deceased elders of the community, the ancestors, spirits, continue to enforce right behavior in this life. But the idea that the supreme creator God should pay attention to the details of human moral behavior, that was new in Mecca. And it was a very upsetting kind of message to the people of Mecca. And they resisted that. Not only that, they said that even if you do get by with your behavior in this life, because you could swing it past the elders and they didn't know, you cannot get by with it, for God will hold you responsible after your death. And so the theme of Judgment Day begins to come into this. Morality, Judgment Day. That twin message of responsibility to the one God who will hold us under judgment for whether we have done what is right or whether we have not. That message, very upsetting. And along with that emphasis upon Judgment Day came the teaching about resurrection. He taught that there will be a great resurrection from the dead, and then this great and final judgment. And that was either laughable, or it was something to either laugh at or to get very angry about. And so the prophet preached these kinds of messages, and this was sort of the core of the message, for 11 years in Mecca without much success, with a lot of persecution, and with only a few individual converts. About that time, in the year 622, came a very, very important turning point in the story of Islam. For in 622, he went to the city of Medina. It happened in this way, that the elders in the city of Medina, about 275 miles north of Mecca, were having a great deal of difficulty with the tribes of their region. That was an oasis region, and they fought a lot over inheritance rights because land to farm was very, very precious in there. And the elders kept trying to mediate all these differences between clans and tribes, and there were Jewish clans there, and there were Arabic clans there, and so forth. They came finally to the Prophet Muhammad, having heard of his message, and they talked with him, and eventually they became persuaded that he should come to Medina and establish the revealed law of God over the city, so that it would no longer be judged and ruled by custom and by council of elders, but by the clear revelation of God. And it would become a whole community under divine revelation and law. That was the invitation, and he accepted that invitation. And with much difficulty, he managed to escape from Mecca and his harassment there, and to take up residence with some 40 companions or so in the city of Medina right away. Now, I said escape. This is the year of the Hijra, the flight, the escape from Mecca to Medina. And this is referred to as Hijra, and it is the beginning of the Islamic era, and we go to an Islamic calendar, and it is year one, AH, after Hijra. And any book we read now, written by Islamic authors and for an English reading public, you're liable to see the dates there, AH, the years from the Hijra, and then in parenthesis, after Christ. So, 622, why is that the beginning of Islam? Why not 611, the year of the revelation? Because this is the moment when Islam became the total rule over a community of people. This is when Islam was really born. For Islam was not simply a message to go out for those who might find it favorable and be converted. It is a total message of social custom, inheritance laws, every kind of law, every facet of life is dealt with in the revelation in Quran. So here is when Islam became Islam, when the whole community, no separation of religion and state, religion and law, for it is all one piece under God and revealed. So he established himself there in Medina with some difficulty there too. And then we have a period of time where there is warfare between Mecca and the Prophet in Medina. And he overpowers the forces of Mecca, much like Gideon did, you know, great odds against him, and still he wins. And finally, the persuasion of even the people of Mecca was that he must be true. For to be so successful, so powerful, against such great odds, he must be true. And so they finally welcomed him back into Mecca. And in the year 630, the city of Mecca became the second great Islamic city. And there he transformed some great traditions of Mecca, and the great pilgrimage of Mecca, which was already there before, became an Islamic pilgrimage and things of this sort. But it is without bloodshed that he came back to Mecca finally and made it the city of Islam. Now, a word about this revelation and about the Prophet. Who is this Prophet Muhammad? He is the last in a long line of God's true prophets. So, Islam says Adam was God's prophet, and Moses was God's prophet, Abraham was God's prophet, Noah was God's prophet, Jesus is God's prophet. And now in these last days, God has brought his revelation again through Muhammad. But he will be different only in this, that he will be the seal of the prophets, the end of the prophetic line. For now, God has brought the message to a people with the linguistic capacity, the writing capacity, to bring that revelation quickly into written form for all time. And no further revelation, no further prophets will be needed. So he is the seal of the prophets. Now, implicit in what I've said is the Islamic attitude toward the revelation of Judaism, revelation of Christianity. The Torah of Judaism is respected as containing elements of the true revelation, for Islam has no doubt but what the prophets of Israel were true prophets, received a true revelation, but it was handed down in an oral tradition for so long and it was corrupted, as is the tendency of human beings to corrupt the truth in their own interest. So their attitude toward the scriptures of Judaism is that it contains some of the truth, but in a corrupted form. Same with the attitude toward the New Testament, the Evangel, as it is referred to in the Quran. The Evangel is, as it is written down, is a distorted bearer of the message which Jesus taught. For Jesus was the true prophet of God, son of Mary, the Virgin, but not son of God. But true man, chosen by God as prophet. And then his followers made him into son of God and sharing divinity with God. So the attitude then toward the people of the book, as they like to call them, the people of the book, Judaism, Christianity, also Zoroastrianism for that matter, is an attitude of respect, for they are people who have in written form elements of the true revelation. But here in the Quran, in the lifetime of one man, God has revealed all of it. Again, for the last time, seal of the prophets. The Quran then is regarded as the word of God in a very, very literal way. The words of God. It is not simply a message born to us by the great poetic ability of a man and then written down. And in order to guard against that way of understanding it, they always speak of the prophet as the illiterate prophet who never wrote a thing, but only recited what God had given to him through the angel Gabriel, and his companions wrote it down. And within a generation, less than a generation after his death, it was all gathered together, all of these individual revelation episodes were gathered together into the holy book, the Quran. And so it has been since. So I'd say that it is a holy book in a little different sense than most people understand by the Bible to be a holy book. And the word revelation means a little something different there than it does to Christians. Do you want to change that now? Say something after you got it going? Okay. I want to talk just briefly about the five pillars of Islam. And that will get us into some very basic practices of Islam. These are not five pillars of belief, but five pillars of practice. Five obligations which rest upon the shoulders of every believer. The first one we will call confession. Testify. And the testimony that is referred to here is a very simple one. I testify that there is no God but the God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Now, when you have said that, given what all I have said up to this point already, you have really said a lot, haven't you? For when you have said Muhammad is his apostle, that automatically means that the whole Quran is words from God, absolute authority. So to make this confession is the act of submitting over and over and over, reminding yourself of your relationship to the God. It is a way of testifying not only to your own heart, which needs to be reminded so constantly, but it is a way of testifying to everyone else of this truth of the one God. So that is the first obligation to make that testimony. The second one is the obligation of prayer. Prayer, as most of you probably know, in Islam is a required activity 5 times each day. These are the obligatory prayers. You can do all the other praying you want, but these are the ritualized prayers, the prayers that are structured and prescribed with some little variations in them, to be sure. These are ritual prayers that are done not only with the mind and the mouth, but with the whole body. All the senses brought together and all the movement of the body brought together in the action of prayer. So the prostrating oneself, the bowing, the standing, the kneeling, and all of these things. The entering into the prayer with ablutions, washing, and so forth. These prayer rituals, 5 times each day, are to help us to remember who is God, and that it's not us, but Him. And therefore they are prescribed. We don't leave it to pray your heart out. No, you pray your heart out some other time. Now is the time to pray what you need to pray, not what you feel like praying. Okay? And that is why it is so structured. You pray facing the holy city of Mecca. Just toss this out. There was first a revelation that said you prayed facing Jerusalem. But when the Jews rejected the prophetic office of the prophet, a revelation came to face Mecca, where the shrine of Allah, the Kaaba, is. I won't say too much more about that. Friday is sort of the gathering day. That is when the prayers, if possible, should be said in the mosque. Otherwise, wherever you are, when the call goes out, you stop for prayer. The third is almsgiving. I'm going to have to be kind of quick about these, so I'll put a couple others up. The giving of alms is a requirement, and it is specified, 2.5% of assets. Now, how that gets figured in all times and in all economies, I don't understand that, because that's changed a million times. But nonetheless, there is a specific giving of alms for the support of the faith, for the care of the needy, and all of those things. Then the fourth one of practice that is required is fasting in the month of Ramadan. I believe we're in that month right now, aren't we? And that has an effect upon activities and interactions between nations in the Middle East. In the month of Ramadan, where fasting from daylight until dusk, fasting from food and drink, and from sexual activity. And from smoking, I think, is usually accepted too as a part of that. And for a month. After dark, moderation is supposed to be the mark of the night and the early morning, though local customs have sometimes violated that, just like we've violated Lenten fasting many places. So fasting, in order that we might remember the plight of those who are always hungry, in order that we might be masters of our own bodily needs instead of slaves to them, and for all kinds of religious reasons, fasting is recommended. Finally, the pilgrimage. Once in a lifetime, every believer should make the pilgrimage to Mecca. Exceptions are even allowed for in the command of the Quran, unless they be too sick to make the journey, or unless they be too poor to make the journey, or unless they be with child, or something like this. But in the piety of the people of Islam throughout the world, every time they turn toward Mecca to pray, 5 times a day, there comes with that longing, when, O Lord, will it be my time to go and walk those paths, to be there in pilgrimage and to participate with those several million people who make that pilgrimage in the pilgrimage month. So making that pilgrimage is an obligation, which I think for many very distant Muslims has to be an obligation fulfilled almost by proxy. That is, if one member of our congregation makes the trip, we help them get ready, we debrief them when they get back, and in that sense we participate. But that is the obligation. So those are the 5 pillars of Islamic practice. There is so much, of course, more that needs to be said, but perhaps I've said enough to kind of get you into something of the spirit of Islam and provoke some of your questions. And we should go from here. Most certain, it is the obligation of Islam to share that revealed law with the entire world.
That's part of the
confession. That's part of it, yes.
Yes, as Justin said, that they can say the word, the Quran is the words of God in a literal way. Mm-hmm. My experience has been of knowing Christians who have seen scriptures that way, but I also know that people here have together their literal interpretations. Mm-hmm. How do they deal with that? Are they still not famous?
No, they have a lot of developed tradition with that. Things I had to leave out, like during the time of the Prophet's own life, he was not only God's prophet in Medina, but he was also an earthly ruler of that city, wasn't he? And it was his job to take the revelation that had been received and apply it to all sorts of circumstances. All right, as that's going on for another 12 or 10 years of his life there, you are building up a whole experience of precedent, like legal precedent. And everything he taught and everything he interpreted and everything he applied was remembered, and eventually, through a very complicated process, that became written down as the hadiths, or the sunnah, the custom of the Prophet. And that, because he was regarded as being rightly and infallibly guided by God in those actions, that became a kind of secondary authority to the Quran. So it could not contradict the Quran, but it went beyond it in offering interpretation. Now, that 10 years certainly couldn't do it either, so. Then you had the successors of the Prophet, and there were traditions, sunnah, hadith, kept from them. And many of the people in Islam see that as a kind of third level of authority. And God guides the community. I don't know how far to go with this. In some cases, it was believed infallibly. He guides the community in its interpretation and application of these things. So out of that has grown a whole tradition of the scholars of law and the legal schools of thought, and a theology, and so on. But yours is the next hand I remember.
I have 2 questions. One is, you mentioned smoking, and I thought Muslims neither smoke nor drive.
Very hard about alcohol. I don't know that that there is a Quranic command about tobacco, and it is often used. I don't know that it has the same status as the prohibition against alcohol.
The other thing was, when being children of Abraham, as the Jews were, when was the separation made?
All right. Judaism traces itself back to Abraham by way of Isaac.
Right.
But before there was Isaac, there was Ishmael. And if you read that portion of Genesis, you will see that when God commanded Abraham to send Ishmael and Hagar away, there's a very compassionate statement there about he too will be great, and a great nation shall come forth from him. And so Islam attaches itself to Abraham by way of Ishmael, Hagar, and Judaism to Islam by way of Isaac and Sarah. So that's the way the tradition is. That would be, but if you think twice, you might understand why they wouldn't. Because anyone who is as right as he is dangerous. Have you ever noticed that people who are really right are also dangerous? That is, if it is God's thing that he brings, and he has absolutely no doubt about that, then they have not just rejected him, they've rejected God. And God punishes those who reject. And he does that through his messengers too. Now they knew that they seemed to suspect that he would become instrumental against them in various military ways, economic ways, and he was. He blocked trading routes and raided trade caravans, which is common sport of the desert anyway. But to do that against the rejectors of God as was a punishment to them. So they knew that would happen, and it did. That's why if somebody's causing you a lot of trouble, it's nicer to keep them where you can control them. Because once they're out of that, they might get really strong. Back here, yes.
Yeah. There's many different other people who are causing nominations today. She has, different factors. Is there a way of briefly describing where and how the difference is?
Yes, no. Now, in order to do what I want to do tomorrow, namely Baha'i, I almost have to tell you how the Sunni and Shiite division took place. And I cannot do that in the couple minutes this morning yet. And that's why I chose just to let that one hang. But there is that main division in Islam, Sunni and Shiite. And it was out of the Shia tradition that the Baha'i faith took off. So I kind of have to make that my preliminary for tomorrow. Yes.
Did you say something about the position of women in the Islamic community?
Well, I'll give you the usual line was that if you understood what the position of women was before the revelation of Islam in Arabia, then you would understand that during the Prophet's lifetime, there was 500% improvement of their condition. Now, that process of women lobbying for better treatment was going on during the time of the Prophet's life. That he kept coming and saying, God surely didn't send you just to the men. And they had their way with the prophet, and a lot of things did happen in a good direction there. Right now, it depends on which Islamic country you look at, and how it's justified, and how things are regarded. There are some countries, like Turkey, where people who consider themselves perfectly good Muslims, where women are in professional practices of all kinds, and in public life, and in Bahrain, and a number of but then, of course, you have a place like Iran. So it's a very mixed thing. The Quran does a lot in defense of women's rights, that Islamic women will have tasted of some of the liberation, I think, will continue to press for interpretations of the Quran that will free this up more and more. A little bit more.
Is the Ayatollah Khomeini then part of this system of legal scholars and that kind of tradition? Is that explained how?
Yes, maybe more so in the Shia tradition. That's part of that long story, trying to describe what the Shia tradition is, that he is probably regarded by his most devout followers as one who is indirectly, but quite infallibly, guided by God. Still
it just seems so
that doesn't mean everybody thinks that.
To reconcile that with the all-merciful, the all-compassionate.
God who intends graciousness toward all, but who is also a God of wrath and judgment. Islam understands that too. So the problem in that tradition, I mean, when we forget that the God whom we call gracious is also a God who holds us responsible and who punishes, unless we want to forget that whole part of our biblical traditions, then we got some of the same problem, I guess. I don't know, does that speak to what you're saying?
It's a matter of degree.
Yeah, it is. And the tone and the way it's, you know, within Islam they'll differ about whether he's going about it right or not, whether he's representing the tradition rightly or not. Many Muslims throughout the world are embarrassed about that whole situation.
I don't know how much you in your own teaching get involved with the political aspects of Islam. Do you see?
Not very much.
Okay. My question was whether or not we are on a collision course as Christians with the Islamic movement, the close friends going to Africa to carry on Christian ministry, radio broadcasting. He stated that we have more fear from Islam in Africa than we do from communism because of the great effort of the Muslim religion to proselytize on the continent of Africa. Which suggests to me that at some point, since there are so many millions of dollars being poured into Africa in mission efforts, that we may be on a collision course at some time between Christianity, the efforts of Christianity to proselytize, and the efforts of Islam.
Well, I think we most certainly have been for a very, very long time. And Islam has been extremely successful, especially in Northern Africa and down through Sub-Sahara already in West Africa. And Islam is very strong down there. It was very congenial for the people. It's so, in a sense, it's so simple. It can be so simple. God is one, and you are to be obedient to him. That's about all there is to it, you know. Now, of course, it can be complicated after that, but that made some sense. Not only that, but little things like the common African practice in those days of polygamous marriages was not something that the Muslims had to come in and condemn, for they saw that as a possibility, whereas the Christians did. And then, when Christians came in to missionize, there were the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Catholics, and the Seventh-day Adventists, and there they were, all within 5 square miles or something like that, shooting for the attention of an African tribe. So I don't know about what we have to fear, but the success of Islam in Africa is very great. But it is also true that the success of Christianity in Africa is greater and greater all the time, until many predict, as you probably have heard as well as I, that the real center of gravity of Christianity in another century will be in Africa, by no means in the so-called Christian West, but in Africa. I don't know, that's some prophets said that.
Well, I just kind of tried to remember the quote on dialogue to John Taylor, who had been here at Holy Village with World Council Churches, and his role has been on Christian-Muslim dialogue. And he has spoken, and there's some takes over there that he's given, on just attempting in these villages to get people to talk to each other a little bit.
There are these conversations going on now, and there's a lot more hope in that respect for mutual understanding than there ever was. I didn't know John Taylor had ever been here, but I know some of his work and respect very much a lot of what he has to say about, you know, what, when we get to this Friday kind of topic, what should be our posture in respect to another religious tradition like this? And that's where what he has to say is very, very meaningful.
He has some wonderful takes where he talks about the Quran. Mm-hmm. I had never understood that, like he talks about the Christmas story, and it's our same Christmas story, and there's dates and palm trees in it, mm-hmm. instead of what's
not.
It's the same story.
Folks, I think I want to respect your time schedules, and we're supposed to stop at 10:45, and it is 10:45. I thank you for your attention.